This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
So my name is Nicholas Lee. I'm an assistant clinical professor of orthopedic surgery. I do upper extremity surgery, so I do shoulder to fingertips. And today our session will be on the broken arm. How are the most common injuries treated? I'm going to be the moderator for this session. It's really my pleasure to introduce two of my colleagues at the Orthopedic Trauma Institute. So we're based primarily out of the Zuckerberg. It's called the Zuckerberg San Francisco General Hospital now. And we're also part of UCSF. And so the first speaker is Dr. Uku Kandemir. He's the professor of clinical orthopedics. And to tell you more about him, I kind of have to go through his education. So he was born in Turkey. He went to Hacettepe University in Ankara, Turkey. He did his medical training there. He started with 2 years of internal medicine. And did you switch over to orthopedics at that time? And he completed his orthopedic residency at Hacettepe. As a chief resident, he spent 3 months in Children's Hospital of Philadelphia at UPenn. And he also did a 15-month fellowship at the Sports Medicine Research Fellowship at the University of Pittsburgh, which is one of the premier sports medicine clinics and universities in the nation. Subsequent to that, he went back to Turkey and was a professor of orthopedic surgery at the Hacettepe University Medical School. And during that time, he developed a passion for trauma surgery, and he came to the UCSF OTI, San Francisco General Hospital, for the trauma fellowship. Currently, we have two trauma fellows per year at our hospital. His clinical interests include trauma and sports medicine, and he is an expert in shoulder and elbow surgery. His research interests include fracture and joint biomechanics, and I think most notably, he's won the Outstanding UCSF Teaching Award twice. And just to go over his travel, he went from Turkey to UPenn, came back from UPenn to Turkey, and then went from Turkey to Pittsburgh, from Pittsburgh back to Turkey, from Turkey to San Francisco, and he's stayed here so far. Well-traveled man, okay? It's really a pleasure to have him here with us today to talk about shoulder, upper extremity injuries, including the shoulder and the elbow, and he will go over some of his topics as we progress. The second speaker, Dr. Nicole Schroeder, she's an assistant professor of orthopedic surgery. In July, she'll be associate professor of orthopedic surgery. She is my partner at San Francisco General Hospital, and we have a joint hand clinic. She did her undergraduate at Williams College, where she played soccer. She went to medical school at Northwestern University. She did her residency here at UCSF and a hand fellowship at Washington University St. Louis, which is one of the powerhouse hand surgery fellowships in the country. She has multiple awards, including Department of Orthopedic Surgery Outstanding Teaching Award back in 2012. This was followed by a UCSF Excellence in Teaching Award in 2013. She got accepted to the Teaching Scholars Program. And most recently, in 2014, she got the Henry Kaiser Award for Excellence in Teaching in the Ambulatory Care Setting. And basically, that's nominated by all the residents in our program for her to get this. And that's an outstanding award. And as you can see, she's very, very dedicated to teaching. Her leadership position includes a myriad of things, such as being the director of our hand service at our county hospital. She's also the director of the orthopedic resident education curriculum. She's also associate residency director and a director of the orthopedic intern surgical skills curriculum. So in her short academic career so far, she's very, very well accomplished. And she will be talking to you guys about wrist injuries.
Thank you for the nice introduction. So I will be talking about the shoulder and elbow fractures because we are talking about the trauma. I'm going to focus mostly about the fractures and about the shoulder and elbow. These are my disclosures. So when thinking about the shoulder and elbow, so our hands are most kind of precise part of our body that we can do a lot of tasks, very kind of applies a lot of dexterity of our daily life. And to be able to use your hand, you need both your shoulder and elbow in good shape. Otherwise, it's very hard to position your hand in the space. Whatever you want to do, you need to have some motion and some ability to use your shoulder and arm. Otherwise, it's hard to use your hand if your elbow or your shoulder is kind of limited. I'm going to talk about first about the activities of daily living. That's what it's called in medicine, ADLs. So activities of daily living are the kind of a basic activities we all have to do to take care of ourselves. So basically, routinely we do every day to be able to take care of ourselves without needing assistance. So what are the six basic ADLs? So eating, bathing, dressing, toileting, and transferring and continence. If you look at this, except the last one, you're going to need part of your arm. Even transferring, it's called walking, but to be able to get up from a kind of a chair or out of bed, you kind of automatically use your arm to push you off too. At least the first four of them, you're going to need your arm. Basically, to be able to be by yourself, independent, you need good arms and your good shoulder and elbows to be able to use your hand. So one of the biggest problems about the shoulder injuries or shoulder trauma and elbow trauma, actually, compared to the other joints, these two joints are more predisposed to develop stiffness compared to other joints, more so than the other joints. Elbow and the shoulder, even without fractures, they may develop stiffness. And stiffness is a big problem. What I tell when I teach my residents is like, it's easier for me to treat bad fractures times 100 than to treat a patient with a stiffness, because we don't have good solutions for them. And it gets a lot of attention and a lot of work to do. And what we mean with stiffness is the reduced motion, right? So what is the reduced motion? We call complete motion or full range of motion is one thing, that you are born or you are your motion without the injury, you have certain motions, and there's some variation between patients and between people, normal people. But functional range of motion, when we call functional, means that depending on whatever the functions you are wanting to do on your daily life, are the functional range of motion for you. There are certain norms developed for certain activities, but if you have a functional range of motion, we are pretty happy with it. This may not mean that you have full range of motion, but if you are able to do everything you want without any limitation, we believe that this is a functional range of motion. And if you have functional range of motion, we say that you don't have stiffness. And I'm going to just go back for a second. Regarding the shoulder, as you can see on this picture, there are a lot of motions on the left-hand side that you can do with your shoulder. I'm just going to show you my shoulder here too. So there's no joint in your body that can do that much of a motion. This is the only joint that can have so much motion. There's no other joints. You may be able to do splits with your legs on the floor. Still, it's not going to match up this much of a motion in your body. Also, there's an implication, obviously. If your normal motion, I'm not flexible neither. I'm kind of average range of motion person. So if you lose some of this motion, your function may be limited to a certain extent. There's no joint that has so much motion, but that's needed for normal function. So if you lose it, if you develop stiffness, this will be a big deal for you. And the shoulder obviously has multiple layers from the skin. Then under the skin, we have our deltoid muscle, a muscle layer. And underneath, we have these rotator cuff muscles too, closer to the bone. I'm not going to talk about all these injuries because I'm going to focus on the fractures. Then on the bare bone, as you can see, this is the shoulder. This is the shoulder blade bone. Shoulder joint is kind of a ball and socket, the ball being on the arm side. And you have this X-ray looks like the arm bone. So proximal humerus fractures are one of the most important fractures in our life because it's getting more and more common. Actually, it's the second most common upper extremity fracture after wrist fractures. Wrist fractures are the most common fractures, no matter where you are in the world, are the most common fractures. These are the second most common upper extremity fracture. It is the third most common in people above 65 years old. Having basically their bone quality is getting a little less and less, especially in females. So hip fractures are the first, wrist fractures are the second, and the third most common is going to be the shoulder area, the proximal humerus fracture, meaning the upper part of the arm bone closer to the shoulder joint. And it's going to increase, and we will see more and more, because the average lifespan is being increased, and people are living longer, but aging is still there. This can happen in different ways. So this can be just when you are falling off a bike, but just falling on the ground or stepping on a curb, this can happen with multiple ways. Actually, you can just fall on your outstretched hand, what we call it, when you're trying to catch yourself. This may start a fracture. It may get even worse when you fall and you hit your shoulder. Usually, it's a fall onto the shoulder, but it can happen even with your trying to catch yourself with your hand. A lot of injuries in the arm happens like that. It happens more commonly in females, about 2 to 3 times more common than males. And this has something to do with about osteoporosis. Because postmenopausal, females get lose a lot of bone and they develop osteoporosis. The bone gets weaker. This is kind of a sign of an osteoporosis too, if you have one of these fractures. The bone quality is usually very poor. It looks like an eggshell, this part of the ball of the shoulder joint. Although it has been quoted in the literature that most can be treated non-surgically, about up to 90%, I think practically in these days, we are able to treat a lot of them and get better outcomes, more than 10% of them. I think we are treating more of them with surgery, to tell the truth, practically. But this is a classical number, so can be treated non-surgically, but I think you can have better outcomes with the current techniques. And the fractures, I'm not going to go too much in detail, obviously, because we are not giving a lecture to the orthopedic residents. So this is like how it looks like normal. And throughout my lecture, you will see that the ones that has a frame with the green are looks like what it looks like normal. And the other ones, are you can compare how abnormal they are. There are different grades or spectrum of it. As every kind of injury in our body, they can be a little small injury or there may be a severe injury. As you can see, this is different than this. There's an injury, but this one is hard to miss. So this is like a little broken. Maybe there's something broken here. You can see a fracture line, but this is very obvious that this is different than this. Anybody can recognize that. And this is a kind of a three-dimensional picture out of a CT scan made with software. You can see that ball is far away where the socket is supposed to be. As I said earlier, most still can be treated non-surgically, especially the ones that doesn't have much displacement of the fracture fragment. That's how we judge them. Usually we judge them how displaced the fractures are. And actually, this is one of the few areas that in orthopedics, there are not much guidelines to it when you need surgery, when you don't. And the main reason is that until about a decade or two ago, the treatment with surgery was not very successful. With the new technological advancements of the fixation materials, I think we are able to fix these fractures better and get better outcomes. But people tried in the 50s and 60s, they tried to make them better with surgery. They weren't successful and they gave up until about a decade or two ago that we get better fixation techniques. The goal when we treat any of these fractures with surgery or no surgery is to be able to restore function, obviously, whatever your function is prior to this injury. The most common way of fixing these fractures in the United States and in North America is usually using one of these plates and screws. As you can see, all these white things are the metal, a plate on the side, and the screws. So this is the most common way. Although rods also can be used, more commonly reported from Europe, the success rate has not been replicated in the United States. So I think still most surgeons in the United States, if the surgery is indicated, will still use some kind of a plate or screws, as you can see here. Then sometimes we cannot fix it, unfortunately. Although you can try to fix it, the goal is to restore function. As I mentioned at the beginning, range of motion is really critical. If you cannot fix it well enough that you can start range of motion, then probably it's not a good thing. If you're going to put the patient in some kind of a splint, not the patient move around, although you may be able to heal the bone, if you're going to develop stiffness, and this is not a good thing. The goal is to be able to restore the function, and function comes from also not only healing of the bone, but to be able to keep the range of motion or the flexibility of the joint. If you cannot fix it well, then we may need to build to we may need to replace it. Replacement is not something the first go because it's not a native joint, it's an artificial joint and it may not last long. Although in the more older the patient is, we may elect to do this because if you think that the patient lifespan is maybe 10, 15 years, if there's a patient who's at 85, 90 year old, this may be a better solution. Actually, at that age, our bones is not going to be as good and we may not be able to fix it, although we may intend to. There are usually the replacement is not going to be a regular replacement that you will have. That's what is called a kind of a reverse shoulder. There's no other replacement that we do reverse. It's kind of doesn't make sense and why you do kind of reverse something. But it's totally the mechanics has been changed in a different way. On this side is a replacement that you will see on a patient who has an arthritis. If you come in with a shoulder arthritis, bad shoulder arthritis, you may end up having a, one of these replacements. Basically a socket on the body side, ball on the arm bone side, and you just replace it, socket on the arm body side and ball on the arm side. In the reverse shoulder arthroplasty that we need to use in the fracture setting because everything is so broken or so displaced that we cannot make a good job to hold everything together, especially in a, you cannot use something like this because it will dislocate. We reverse it. This is an idea by a surgeon, Dr. Garamond from Europe, from France, who basically this thing all relies on the deltoid. If you have an intact deltoid muscle, which usually the case, 99% of the time, you can basically reverse this and you don't have to rely on your rotator cuff and you can still have good function. Not perfect function, but good function. This is kind of a choice, a backup choice for most people that if you cannot fix it. It's called reverse because you are reversing the ball and socket places in the shoulder. I'm going to show a couple of cases that you kind of you may find that some of your friends or family members may end up with something like this. So this is a 54-year-old flight attendant, right hand dominant, had an injury falling onto the shoulder, nothing specific, no motor vehicle accident, nothing major, and had this shoulder injury, came to the emergency room and ended up in my clinic 5 days after. And these are x-rays that's done 5 days after. Again, this is how it looks like normally, and if it's like this patient's x-rays, you can see there's a fracture line here and there's another fracture line here. So they don't look like bad. As I said, one of the things about the shoulder and elbow, they may tend to be stiff. If you can treat this patient non-surgically, actually, if they're amenable regarding the fracture pattern, it may be better if you can treat non-surgically. So for this patient, everything will look well aligned, still broken but well aligned, everything relative to each other, the parts of the bone looks normal. So I elected to start the therapy with non-surgery, no surgery. Obviously, you may change your the treatment pattern depending on how the patient does in follow-up. If start things getting displaced, you may need to recommend surgery too. So I use a brace like this that holds the arm in relatively normal position. In the middle picture here, you can see there are muscles that's kind of trying to pull every single part around the ball in different directions. So that's why this is kind of the most neutral position that you can keep everything, all the muscle forces in more neutral position. And I keep this for about 6 weeks in this patient, with or without surgery. Even you have surgery, that's what I would recommend, to use a brace like this, except the times that you are doing your home exercise program or you are working with your physical therapist. So this patient comes back for a follow-up because we want to see if anything's going to get more displaced at 3 weeks. Everything looks about the same, as looks close to what normal looks like. And I continue to treat this patient. It's about 3 months later, and this is about 6 months later. It's not perfect, but it's pretty good, and it's healed. In the meantime, we did the physical therapy, and this is her results about 6 months. She was able to get close to normal range of motion without difficulty, and one of the requirements apparently for flight attendants, they should be able to get a luggage over the top counter, otherwise they cannot go back to the full duty. So this is another patient. I'm going to switch to another spectrum, like the worst injury here. So this is a patient, as you see, this is again a normal x-ray. This is a 29-year-old after a motorcycle accident. She had bilateral shoulder injury. The other one was not major, so I'm going to include this one. As you look at these two pictures, they don't even look like similar, anything close. Even you show this on orthopedic surgeons, they will say, like, this is really, really bad. It's hard to know where is the ball. Where's the ball part of the joint? Because this is that you need for a joint to function. There's the socket in there. It's not broken, but where's the ball? So obviously he's 29. As I mentioned earlier, we cannot really try to do a replacement because replacements may last maybe 10, 15, 20 years, but he's 29. It's not going to last for his average lifespan. So we try not to do replacements in young people. So obviously this is a backup plan. When I talked to this patient before going to the surgery, I told him that this is a really bad injury. We may need to replace it if we cannot fix it. We cannot put it together. It was kind of a plan B. So starting in the surgery, I'm not going to show too much of the pictures, but this is also another picture of the same patient. Like multiple parts broken. The ball is not a ball anymore. It's kind of an exploded ball. We start putting these things together. There are pictures, x-ray pictures that we take during the surgery as we proceed. Start putting this together, trying to make a ball out of it. I think I was able to slowly make something that looked like proximal humerus. It looks like a normal with time. And I use a cadaveric bone, kind of one of the leg bone parts, put it inside of his bone too. A lot of technical parts of it, but this is normal. This is where we started with him. And I was able to put this together. But this still needs to heal. He needs to work with physical therapy. And hopefully one of the problems is that the versus the injury, we are worried that the blood supply to the ball may not survive. Because the versus the injury, the blood vessels that's coming to that fractured fragment is going to be more injured, and they may not survive. Obviously, I told everything to this patient. So he said, I don't think I have the full follow-up. The 4.5 months follow-up, is everything still holding up together? It's slowly healing. He's working. He's still stiff. He didn't get close to normal range of motion. But after this bad injury, he's getting about, I don't have his photos, but he's able to get about the head level, close to that level. Nothing more than that yet. I think for him, considering the bad injury, if he can get reasonable motion, I don't think he's going to get normal motion at all. This will be even if he can use this arm to take care of himself without any assistance. I have some pictures at 4.5 months, actually. So as you can see, there are significant difference between two sides, on the back side too. So this is another patient, is a 30-year-old and an executive assistant. Female, very flexible on the contralateral side, have great range of motion. And with this fracture, as you can see some pictures, the 3D pictures, we were able to put together again using some plate and screws. As you can see, this is normal. This is how it looks like. Actually, if your patient is very compliant too, you can get very good motion at the end. And the compliance of the patient is really important. This is another patient, 58-year-old. Normal picture again here. The ball doesn't look like a ball. Tripped over a dog, leash of her dog. We put together, and this is how it looked like on follow-up. And if you can get these very good results, as again, this shoulder is not going to be the same. There's a difference. This is your normal side. This is your injured side. But if you can get the arm up here, I'm very happy, and I will smile more that day when I see this patient in clinic. This is another patient. This is a 66-year-old diabetic. So the more comorbidities a patient has, the bone quality is not going to be as good. And the more over like 65 female postmenopausal, the bone quality gets worse. It's hard to put things together. And usually the fracture pattern is worse, even with the same amount of impact. In this patient, unfortunately, we weren't able to put things together. And for a 66-year-old female, this is a better choice, I believe, to replace it. They don't need too much physical therapy. Stiffness is not a big issue. They can get good motion, not perfect motion. And they can, at that age, usually are not throwing baseball a couple times a week. So you are pretty good, and you usually, this this prosthesis hopefully will survive another 10, 15 years and usually will last her lifespan. And this is her range of motion. As you can see, the range of motion is kind of not higher up as the other patients that I showed you. They're not going to be as high. One of the things about this reverse shoulder, some patients may get higher, but more reliably with what we tell the patients that they're going to be about the head level or maybe a little higher. More than that, it may or may not happen depending on your function of your deltoid. Obviously, surgery is not always the answer, and there are a lot of things that can go wrong, especially if not done right. I collected a bunch of pictures here that things didn't go well, things falling apart, a broken screw, broken plate, the plate pulled off, the ball is falling off, the screws pull out, like everything's kind of pulling out. Another problem, sometimes the screws start poking through the head, through the ball, because the head settles and tries to poke on the socket side. All these things can happen too. So if things are not done well and the healing does not happen, we may end up this kind of a problem. I have a 50-50 rule in clinic. That's what I tell the patients. What is this 50-50 rule? When I treat any shoulder or elbow injuries, I tell them the 50% is me doing the surgical part, and the other 50% is the patient doing physical therapy with physical therapists and doing home exercise program. To be able to get the 100%, only way would be to combine both. Because I do my best with every fracture, but I have patients who can get better function. Some of them don't get the better function. I think it relies a lot on the patient commitment to be able to hit the target, the 100%. Yes, they may not be able to get the 100%, but if you shoot for 100%, I think you have a better chance that you can get there. I apply this 50-50 rule all the time. Now I'm going to talk a little bit about the elbow, walking down the elbow. So there are a lot of muscles and there are a lot of ligaments around the elbow, obviously. I'm going to talk about the bones. The thing about the elbow, all the nerves are very close by to the bone. There are three nerves that helps us to move, to use our hands distally too. And they are really important. Any little injury to these nerves are going to cause a lot of problems and you may not be able to use your hand. All this, the big blood vessel just in front of the elbow too, this is the only blood supply distal to the hand. This commonly, as I mentioned earlier, can happen like fall onto an outstretched hand. I'm going to start the lower part of the arm bone, the distal humerus. So this usually happens after a fall or different type of injuries. For a distal humerus fracture in an adult, the treatment is 99.99% of the time is surgery, because the outcomes without surgery is not good at all. They don't do well. Adults don't do well. Some kids we may be able to treat without surgery or with kind of less invasive methods. But if it's an adult as a distal humerus fracture, you cannot treat without surgery. You need to treat with surgery. So I put again a normal pictures and a fractured one here. This is a 54-year-old nurse, fell at work actually. So I had this kind of injury. This is a lateral view, a side view. This is a normal, this is how it looks like in this patient. This is a three-dimensional picture out of a CT scan. This looks like how normal. And this is a broken one. You can see the fragments. IT technology also helps us to understand this, pick these things and plan the surgical part much easier. And this is how it's fixed. So this is before. We use some plate and screws to put this thing together and we try to make it close to normal. As you see on the side view, again, this is normal. This is her broken arm and this is after the surgery. And with good physical therapy, you can get a lot of motion back, not normal. Anybody who has an elbow injury, a severe enough elbow injury, regardless how we treat them, with or without surgery, we tell them that they're going to lose about 5 to 10 degrees. They may not be able to make it straight like this. They're going to lose about 5 to 10 degrees compared to their other side. And a lot of females actually are more flexible. So they hyperextend. They may be able to make it straight, but their other side is probably extending more, another 10 degrees. As you can see on this patient, she's pretty straight on this side, but it's probably lacking about 10, 15 degrees. But the more important thing about the elbows, it's not about making it straight. I concentrate more and try to have the patient focus on more bending of the elbow. Because almost everything functionally we do is with bending of the elbow. Eating, washing your face, washing your head, trying to clean yourself, everything or changing your clothes, you need more bending of the elbow than straightening out. Yes, to reach something out, you may need to make it straight, but you can just move your body to get it there. But you cannot just change your body's position to be able to eat. Doesn't matter. You need some bending of your elbow. Another patient is a 94-year-old. As I mentioned earlier, the older we get, our bones age as our skin too. So it doesn't stay the same. Regardless how active you are, if you are 94-year-old, your bones are 94-year-old. If you are active, this may be a little better, but still it's 94-year-old. It has been 94-year-old since they are born. So they get weaker. So this is a view, this is a normal view. There are some breaks here. And the elderly you are, so the fracture patterns are more smaller fragments, worse fractures. So in this patient, actually we ended up doing a replacement. As I mentioned earlier in the shoulder, you may need to do a replacement because you may not be able to fix it. The bones are weaker. No matter how hard you try, you may not be able to fix it. And this is an elbow replacement, kind of a hinge elbow. It works great if you are really elderly. The downside of it, you cannot really put too much weight and to do too much. The limitation is about 5 pounds for the rest of your life. That's why for elbow replacement, we try really not to do it unless it's necessary. In younger patients, they don't last too long. Unless we don't have any other choice, we may be able to do it. But I think the technology for elbow replacement is not close to what we have with the hip and knees and the shoulders. It's still, our technology is not as good for the elbow. But we will do it if we don't have any other choice. Sometimes extra bone formation forms around the elbow that may limit the motion. Actually, with severe injuries, the muscles and the soft tissues around the elbow and the shoulder get affected. But for the elbow specifically in our body, there's a tendency to lay extra bone formation around the joint, and this may limit the motion actually. This may block the motion, and we may need to go back and take out this extra bone formation. It's usually related with the injury itself. So these are kind of failures, as you can see here. If you don't fix it well, things may fall apart and may not heal. So there are always pitfalls in the surgery. Now I'm going to talk the other bone in the elbow. This is our radial head and neck area. So this was upper where your head is your hand is down here. So this little bone, it's kind of a round shape. This fracture happens in this area in all ages and affects the forearm's prospination. What's prospination? I'm going to try to show in these pictures here. So this is how the injury happens. This is how the broken part, as you can see here, this is normal. It can break in multiple patterns. I thought it had a picture. So I think I have a picture later. So what's prospination is, I'm going to show it myself. So pronation, supination means this. So basically when you keep your arm attached to your body, moving your hand in and out, facing your palm up or down, this bone actually rotates around the other bone that's here. Rotates around the other bone. That's how we can move your hand from a kind of a writing position to try to grab something like a dish or anything like that. So you got to move your hand, and all this motion actually is coming from your elbow with the more rotation of that bone. So this, as you can see, this is how it normal looks like, and it's pretty badly broken. These are the side view of the same picture. It's pretty different than the normal. So this is prospination. That's what I was trying to show. Basically, this is the palm and this is the dorsal side of your hand. But everything basically rolls over, rotates, these bones rotate around each other to get this motion. This is a 27-year-old female, a young patient. So have been seen in 5 days in my clinic. Had a little break here. We follow these patients if we try to start non-surgical treatment because they may displace in the following weeks, especially the first 3 weeks is critical period for these fractures that they may displace. We saw her in about 1 week, it's more displaced. So in this case, this is not going to work well for a 26-year-old. We wanted to make it close to anatomic. We used like mini plate and screws, the smaller bones are, that we are using more smaller hardware. There's small plate and screws that's in the surgery, the same plate as you can see. So everything held together with plate and screws. Then she heals. It's about 9 months. She has some pain because I think it was irritating. This plate was irritating her soft tissues. This is her range of motion. As you see, she's still working on the bending part of it. We took out the plate finally because it was rubbing against her. Unfortunately, some of the screws don't come out easily, and this one, the screw heads got broken. The rest remained in the bone, and I didn't want to dig into the bone. There's another one, 34-year-old, full of a bike, as you can see. There's no way you can put this together, and we ended up replacing it. As you can see over and over, when you cannot fix it, we have replacement parts. Unfortunately, they may not last as long. For this part of our body, we use another metallic implant to substitute the radial head, try to put it something similar in there. And I'm going to tell a little couple minutes about the olecranon part of it. Olecranon is the other bone in our body around the elbow area. It's shaded in the yellow here. So the most important part of the olecranon part of it is that our triceps is attached to it. And the way we extend the arm, when our triceps kind of contracts, we are able to make our elbow extended. This is how it works. When you look at from the backside, is where our triceps are, and they are attached to this bone up here. This is the attachment of it. The thing is that when it's broken, the triceps tries to pull it, and it gets displaced. Again, this fracture is a surgical fracture, what we call it. You're going to need surgery unless there's an exception that everything looks perfect and it still doesn't look displaced as an adult. It happens with a fall onto elbow or just on an arm. There are multiple patterns that you can see the fractures. It's normal from the side view. There's a small break here. As you see, it gets displaced with the pull of the triceps, but it may get even worse with a more severe fracture pattern. And if you leave it alone, that's what happens with the pull of the triceps. This keeps going up and up, and you're not going to be able to actively move your arm, use your triceps. Your triceps will be useless because your insertion of this muscle is not there, is not functioning. If you use it, you usually use some plate and screws or some wires to hold, or some screws to hold it together. There are different ways to fix it. Our worry is always that the triceps is going to win over, and before it heals, the tip, the fracture part, may escape our fixation. This is kind of a bad outcome. I'm going to finish up with this. As a 57-year-old female, had some upper extremity injuries and surgeries regarding the nerves. Prior to that, had some problem. Had something like this, an olecranon fracture, but had some issues in the radial head too. As you can see, they are different. We put this together, but the radial head also is replaced, not only the broken part. These are one-year follow-up. She worked really hard to be able to get the range of motion back, and I reiterated every single clinic visit that she needs to do that. And this is at her one-year follow-up. As you can see, she lost about 10 degrees, as I mentioned, with any elbow injuries, but she was able to do full pronation supination and get very good bending, maybe short of 5 degrees. She got the functional range, what we call it. In summary, our goal is to return to your prior functional level, whatever it is, whatever you were playing or whatever you were doing prior to your injury. We're not going to make you a basketball player if you get an injury if you're not playing basketball. Range of motion is critical. So motion is life. To be a lively person, you need some motion. And my 50-50 rule, we shoot for 100%. The only way to get it, by shooting the target 100%. Thank you.
Good evening. It's very exciting to see everyone here. Thanks for coming to join us in our orthopedic department at UCSF and the new Zuckerberg Hospital. So I get to talk about the wrist and how are the most common injuries diagnosed and treated. And first and foremost, I think when people think of the upper extremity, this is the way that we as orthopedists think about it. So when we're talking about what Dr. Kanemir was talking about, we're really talking about the arm and the elbow. So that's the upper part of the arm. The forearm is the part that has the radius and the ulna. And then finally, We talk about the wrist and the hand. And the wrist is this area here, and that's sort of where my focus today is in talking about the most common fractures. And as we had mentioned before, distal radius is actually the most common fracture in the upper extremity, and it happens to lie in the wrist. So we're going to spend a lot of time talking about how they happen, how we treat them, and what the outcomes from them are. So when we talk about the broken wrist, there are really four areas that we talk about. We talk about distal radius fractures, which we'll go over, which you can actually see here in this x-ray. Scaphoid, which are sometimes called navicular. That's the scaphoid bone, which is this bone here, also broken. Triquetrum, which are really glorified wrist sprains. They're actually avulsion injuries that most often happen in a fall in an outstretched hand. And then finally, boxer's fractures. And while that's not part of the hand, it actually is the most common hand injury that we see. So I thought it would be important to mention it. And I would bet that probably everyone in this room either knows someone or had one of these injuries themselves. Talking about a wrist radiograph, I think it's always important to orient yourself to what we're talking about here first. And what you see here is this is a wrist radiograph. Now, the wrist radiograph differs from a hand radiograph because it depends on where you actually center the beam. And so for a wrist radiograph, it's centered right here at the wrist joint. So this is officially called the wrist joint. The radiocarpal joint is right here. And so what we're talking about is radius, ulna, the scaphoid or the navicular bone, and then finally the triquetral fracture. And so all four of these can be injured in any time that you fall, here being the most important one. In a hand radiograph, the boxer's fracture is actually the fifth metacarpal neck fracture, sometimes seen as a fourth. We'll talk a little bit about it later and why it's actually a misnomer, because you very rarely see good boxers ending up with this fracture. So facts, a little bit about what is the distal radius, why it's important. So it's actually 25% of all the fractures that you see in kids, 18% in adults, and accounts for almost 3% of all ED visits. The distal ulna, I always think it's important to mention when you talk about distal radius fractures, because a lot of time when people come to see us, they say, well, I broke both bones, right? And they think it's even more severe because they broke both of the bones. But most of the time that we actually see a distal radius fracture, it has some type of distal ulna fracture. Doesn't mean that it's more severe. It just means that there's a transmission of the energy that goes from the radius into the ulna. Most of the time, we actually treat the ulna non-operatively, so it doesn't necessarily affect the outcome. Scaphoid is the most common broken bone in the wrist. And then finally, boxer's fractures are 20% of all hand fractures. So, distal radius fractures. So what is the cause? And Dr. Kanemir sort of nailed it earlier. It's the foosh, right, which is the fall in the outstretched hand. It's very easy to say why most people have injuries. They just fall in their hand. And when I looked up foosh online, it shows you these highly caffeinated mints. So it's not what it is, but I thought this was interesting. I have never seen these, but I feel like I need to find where they are, because if you look in most orthopedic notes of hand surgeons, it says foosh. So maybe someone will read them one day and think like, wow, people ate a lot of those mints. It's the fall in the outstretched hand. And it puts the load, you know, through the wrist, and sometimes it extends up into the elbow, and sometimes it goes on to the shoulder. But distal radiuses are usually classified into they affect the young and they affect the old, and they're different mechanisms. And most of the time in the young, you see it's related to sports injuries. You see it related to car accidents. And in the elderly patients, you see most of the time distal radiuses are associated with low energy falls. We obviously see it a lot in patients that are osteoporotic. It's actually one of the most common fractures that you see after hip fractures in people that have osteoporosis. And it means that the fractures end up being oftentimes more severe because the bone isn't nearly as good. So instead of just having one crack, it crumbles. And that's why you see those what we call comminuted fractures, so many parts to those fractures. The other thing when we talk about breaking your wrist and why it's important for us to know that you have osteoporosis is even when we reduce it, meaning you come to the emergency room, we try and push it back to the right place and hold it there with a cast, if you have osteoporosis, the chance of that fracture actually staying put and not moving goes way down. So the chance of us needing to operate on you in the future, even if we get it in the right position, goes up when your bone isn't great. So when you fall, this is what happens. The wrist extends, the force gets transmitted through the hand, and the wrist breaks. And this is a radius. You can see it breaking here. And it breaks at the most, the weakest part of the bone, which is called the metaphyseal region of the bone. So you have your articular surface here. You have the shaft here. And right where they meet is the metaphysis, where you have the very thin bone and where it tends to break. So as a physician, what do I actually care about? Well, number one, obviously, I care about the patient, right? So when I meet anybody that has broken their wrist, there are things that I want to know. So I want to know what's their age, what's their activity level, because it's certainly, while the bone ages appropriately as you get older, patients don't always age appropriately, right? So just because you see a 85-year-old, they might be acting like they're a 70-year-old. They might be acting like they're a 40-year-old. And their bone might be acting like that if they've done a really good job taking care of it. But, you know, you may see a 90-year-old or even a 60-year-old who's acting like they're 90-year-old. And so those all influence how I'm going to care for a patient. Obviously, medical comorbidities, because if you see somebody that's just too sick to have surgery, it's already made the decision for me. I'm not going to be able to operate on that patient, and we're going to need to treat them non-operatively. If they have other injuries, meaning if they've been in a really bad car accident and they have an associated femur fracture in their leg and they need surgery on that and they're going to have to bear weight through crutches, it's something that we have to consider. Are we going to operate on it so that we can get them up and move them early? Do they need it for bed transfers? Do you need to stabilize their wrist so that they can actually do some transfers? Again, I mentioned we want to talk about their activity level, the timing of their injury. So how soon after the fracture do we need to see them? How soon are they coming into our clinic? Because certainly if they've come in 2 months after a fracture, well, that fracture is already healed, right? So then am I really going to treat it if the bone is already healed? But if I see them at 1 week and it's displaced, I can treat it. If I see them two days after it happened, it's displaced, I have the potential that maybe I can push on it and get it back in the right position and take a fracture that maybe needed surgery and make it not needing surgery. And then again, there's the physical exam, because it's always important to check to say, hey, how was your wrist functioning before you fell? Did you have any numbness or tingling in your hands before you fell? No, you didn't. But do you have it afterwards? Because when you fall and you break a bone, it bleeds, right? And your hand doesn't have a lot of space for swelling, right? So if you break your wrist and it swells a lot, you could develop acute carpal tunnel, which means acute numbness and tingling in your hand from blood in a small space. And those are something that we consider a surgical emergency, meaning if you lose all the sensation in your finger after you break their wrist, that's not normal, right? So that's something that would push me to operate on you. And as Dr. Candemir also mentioned, we care about the fracture, right? Because our goal is to get you back to your functional level. So we want to restore anatomy so that we can restore function. So what are the parameters that we actually care about? How do we make the decision, aside from talking to you as a patient, aside from seeing your x-rays, what do I actually care about when I look at an x-ray? So first off, some of the things that you may hear, whether you're talking to someone who's broken their wrist or you see a doctor. I think one of the things that we hear oftentimes is, well, I have a compound fracture. There's two things in this word. Compound usually means it's an open fracture, meaning the bone was sticking out of the skin. And fracture, oftentimes we have people that come to us and you'll say, oh, you have a fracture. Oh, no, I broke my bone. Well, we actually have to say that's the same thing. It's just it's how we use it in medical terminology. A broken bone is a fracture. It just means the same thing. So you may hear if your bone was sticking out of the skin, it's called a compound or open fracture. Comminuted, as I mentioned before, if it's in a lot of pieces, you'll see that. Right, and you can see here in this x-ray, so here's that wrist. Unfortunately, I didn't think to do your green box of normal versus abnormal. But I think what you can see is that this piece has multiple fractures of the distal radius. And like I mentioned, it has that associated distal ulna fracture. Because for this fracture to move that much, the load and the impact of injury actually goes all the way through here and tears off the top of the ulnar styloid. But you can see that this bone is in multiple pieces. In comparison to this one, so this is a side view x-ray, and you can actually see that it's in one piece. So there's one part here and another part here. And then there are other words that we talk about. We talk about displaced fractures, meaning that it's moved. So normally a bone should line up relatively straight, like this one. This is a lateral view of a distal radius. And you can see that here's a fracture line, but it really hasn't moved very much. Versus a displaced fracture, which here's that fracture line, and you can see that this distal fragment is really displaced, right? And you can see that in the x-ray here, that this is displaced from where it normally should be. extra-articular and intra-articular fractures are other things that we consider. So what we usually tell people and what we know from the literature is when the fracture goes into the joint, it disrupts that articular cartilage, right? And it disrupts that cartilage and it can kill the cartilage where the fracture is, and then it actually has to heal with a different type of cartilage. So it actually can predispose you to developing arthritis. So when it's intra-articular, we care because if there's a step off at the joint, meaning that it doesn't line up straight like this, it lines up like this, you put much more load through part of that fracture. And so you increase the load to a smaller area, and that increases your risk of developing arthritis. So we try and restore it. Same thing happens if you have a big gap at a fracture. You aren't bearing any load through here, so you increase the load on the sides. So those are the things that we care about. And again, you can see that in this picture here. Here's an intra-articular non-displaced fracture. Here's an intra-articular displaced fracture with this big fragment here. So the actual radiographic evaluation. So when I get these x-rays in clinic, I look at the patient, I talk to the patient, and then I look at the x-rays because I need to make a decision as to whether I think, okay, we need to do surgery on this or we don't. So here's an actual image, an AP and a lateral of a patient. And if you look at this AP, so this is really actually a PA, but you're looking at the wrist hand-on. So it's like this. What you see here is that you can actually see this fracture right here, and then you see the line extending, the radial lucency, so it's a little bit darker extending up into the joint. So you look at that and you think, well, that doesn't look quite so bad because it doesn't look like there's a step off at the joint. It's one nice kind of straight line here. I don't see a huge gap. You can see the fracture line extending up there. And maybe there's a fracture of the ulnar styloid. So on this view, it looks relatively okay. On the lateral view, this is the same fracture. You can see that the wrist, if I draw a line up the wrist, doesn't line up with a radius, right? So this is actually a displaced fracture. So there's actually parameters that we use when we make these decisions of whether to operate or not. And one of them is something called radial inclination. So if you look at what a normal radius looks like relative to an ulna, the radius actually sits higher than the ulna. So in the average population, your radius is taller than your ulna. And then the tip of it is called your radial styloid. And here is the part that articulates with the ulna right here. And this angle it makes right here is about 21 or 22 degrees. So that's something, we mark that down. If you look down at this x-ray here, if I were to draw an angle, I would say it's probably somewhere between about 15 and 20. So she's lost a little bit of her radial inclination, but it's really not that bad. The second parameter that we talk about is radial height. So the actual distance from the tip of your styloid down to here, which is the ulna. This is about a centimeter. And so you can see in here, if I drew a line here to here, so she's lost a lot of height, right? And remember what I was saying is that the radius is usually taller than the ulna. You can see how much taller the ulna is here. And why does that matter? Well, it actually matters for a couple reasons. It matters because most of the load is actually borne through the radius. So when you walk around and grab something with your hand, 80% of that load, when you're picking up something, if you were doing a handstand, goes through your radius. Only 20% goes through the ulna. And when you have a change in height and the ulna becomes more prominent, you put more and more weight. So every centimeter of change in height, you actually have about a 20% increase in load to the ulna. And the ulna isn't used to that. They don't expect it. That's not part of what we are designed to do. The other thing is you get something called ulnar impaction, right? So every time your ulna goes over like this, it's hitting the wrist. It's not supposed to do that. That's why people end up with ulnar-sided wrist pain when they treat these without surgery or without a reduction. One of the final parameters that we talk about is on the lateral x-ray, which you see here, the radial tilt. So normally in anybody's radius, if you take it, you should have a volar tilt, meaning it should be tilted towards the palm about 11 degrees. You can see here it's tilted not towards the palm. This is the thumb here. It's tilted backwards, and it's tilted backwards about 20 degrees, which makes it about 30 degrees off of normal. So all of these things are parameters that I use in my decision making to decide whether I should operate on this wrist or not. So operative indications. So it really depends on the patient, and it depends on the fracture, depends a lot on the timing and the situation. What our academy, so this is Academy of Orthopedic Surgeons, what we say is radial shortening greater than 3 millimeters, a dorsal tilt of greater than 10 degrees, so 20 degrees off of what the normal is, any intra-articular displacement or step-off. There's actually no real consensus on that radial inclination, but most people say more than 5 degrees loss of inclination, you consider surgery. Now, again, these are the textbook answers. This is not including what is going on with the actual patient. And why? So why does this matter? Well, like I was saying, the loading patterns change if you change the morphology or the geometry of your wrist. So in the normal anatomy, we mentioned that only 20% of the load goes through the ulna. Well, if you tilt it back 20 degrees, like in that x-ray that we saw, the ulna bears about 50% of the load. If you change the length by 2.5 millimeter, the ulna now bears 42% of the load. So that's a lot of change in a small bone that's not expecting it, is not ready for it, and can't really handle it. It also, as you dorsally angulate, so as the wrist breaks, and most fractures tilt back like that, as you tilt backwards, you decrease your grip strength and your endurance. So with 20 degrees of dorsal angulation or just 10 degrees loss of radial inclination. So all of these things, what do they add up to? Well, they add up to wrist pain, right? They add up to potential for increasing arthritis. And they add up to the potential that you don't have a normal grip strength or normal function in your hand. And the goal, again, is to restore your function. So how do we fix this? We fix distal radiuses in so many different ways, but the most important thing is to preserve that function, is to get you back to the what you were doing prior to the injury. So if our goal is to restore or preserve your function, we need to restore the anatomy to prevent the arthritis, right? So we have to correct that height, that tilt, and that inclination. And we need to restore the articular surface to prevent the arthritis. So non-operative management, and I think that although we're here to discuss how we fix it, one of the mainstays of distal radius fractures is non-operative management. So the first line of defense is how you're treated in the emergency room, in urgent care when you first see us, because oftentimes we treat these non-operatively. So if we can get you back to normal anatomy or close to normal anatomy, we can just treat you with a cast. And this is just a short arm cast. And I think probably for anyone here that's either seen somebody with a distal radius fracture or who's had one themselves, people come home after they've been in the emergency room with those big splints that go all the way around the elbow and these big bulky dressings. And you're like, well, I've seen people in casts. Why can't I have one of those? And the reason being is that when we actually first treat you in the emergency room, we reduce a fracture, we put what we call a 3-point mold on it, which means that we hit it on the volar side and the dorsal side to try and get it molded into the exact right position to do counterforces to the way that the fracture wants to displace, right? We get a nice mold on it, and then we need to immobilize you. And as Dr. Kandemir was talking about, in pronation and supination, what happens is the radius and the ulna flip over each other. So we actually have to immobilize the elbow for a short period of time to try and prevent any motion at the wrist. So that's why people have for about 2 weeks, they have their elbow immobilized in those big bulky dressings. At 2 weeks, if the x-ray still continues to look good, we can switch you to a cast because that's when the fracture starts to get sticky, meaning that it should hold even with some motion at your elbow. So that's why we do it for 2 weeks. If we're going to treat you non-operatively, we get an x-ray at time zero, which means the first time you've come in the emergency room, week one, week two, and sometimes week three. And people say, why do you get all these x-rays? That's a lot of radiation. But the reason we do it is because if fractures tend to fall, meaning if they displace, they're going to displace most likely in the first 2 weeks. The incidence of displacement, as I mentioned before, goes up with osteoporosis, and it goes up with age. So if you're over the age of 42 or 50, as you get older, the chance of displacing in those first 2 weeks goes way up. So that's why we get x-rays reliably at time 0, 1, and 2. In the osteoporotic patient, I sometimes will continue to get x-rays at week 3 just to make sure that it's holding where it should be because it takes a little bit longer for those fractures to get sticky. And my goal in that non-operative treatment is to get you to the acceptable, what we mentioned before. So ideally, we want your wrist in the neutral position or about 5 degrees of dorsal angulation, right? We want to have radial height within those parameters I mentioned before. And then what is acceptable really depends on your age and your functional level. We have certainly, Dr. Lee and I certainly have treated older patients who have a lot of medical problems that have horrible looking wrists simply with casts, right? Because their functional level prior to this was very minimal. And even studies show that over the age of 60 or 65, depending on which way you look at it, that there's actually no difference at 1 year between operative treatment and non-operative treatment. I mean, that's like a pretty big statement for an orthopedic surgeon who wants to operate to make. That's actually what the studies show. So we treat a lot of those fractures non-operatively. Even though they don't look good and they make us cringe, right? The functional outcome is the same in a year. But you do reliably have to tell people that it's going to take a year to get you back to where you were prior to this. When we do treat them operatively, most of the time this is how we treat them. And this is what we call a volar locking plate. And so what you can see is we make an incision on the palm side of the wrist down here, and we get down to the bone and we reduce it to get that inclination right, to get the height right. And on the lateral, we want to try and get a volar tilt or at least get them to neutral. Now, the reason why these work really well, it used to be years ago that these were treated with either pins, dorsal plates, so plates on the back side of the wrist, and then only really in the past 15 years have we had this invention of the volar locking plate, which is a much more stable construct. The volar side, there's more soft tissue covering the volar side, so there's not really a need to remove the plates. And the dorsal side, oftentimes there were thick plates, and the tendons are right there that let you extend your finger. So that's actually why we switched most of the time to volar plates. With these locking screws, which means it locks the construct to the bone, they're very solid, and you can get people moving immediately after surgery. So my protocol for doing these is usually when I say discuss surgery with someone, I get them moving a few days after surgery. So they go into a removable wrist splint, and they come out with therapy to start their range of motion. And as I mentioned before, something to always consider is to talk to them about whether they have numbness or tingling in the hands, because that's actually really important as well, because we may have to do a carpal tunnel release at the same time. So just a few other ways of how these are treated. So you can treat these with pins. You can treat these with an external fixator, which you see here. Most of the time, though, the volar plate is what you tend to see. So scaphoid fractures, here's another injury that we most commonly see. You can see the scaphoid fracture right here. This is that scaphoid or the navicular bone that I was talking about earlier, and here's the actual fracture line, most common place to have the fracture. So it's often missed, and the reason it's missed is it lies at a funny angle relative to the rest of the bones. It's actually tilted forward about 42 degrees on average. So you have to get specific x-rays, and it has to correlate with a clinical exam. So it often gets missed because you don't see it on x-ray, because you're not thinking about it, and because they don't get appropriate follow-up. Some people just say it's a wrist sprain. So diagnosis, snuff box tenderness, we get the x-rays, and oftentimes in clinic we'll order an MRI to confirm it. But snuff box is this area on the back of your hand. If you abduct your thumb, you'll see it right here. It's where you're tender when you fall. That's called your snuff box. So it's between two extensor tendons, and yes, snuff box is what you think it means. But you have tenderness there. But the accuracy of a clinical exam is very low, so the sensitivity isn't great. So oftentimes what we do is we put people who we suspect have this type of fracture, they go in a splint. We see them in clinic about 2 weeks later, and we get another x-ray. Or if the index of suspicion is really high, we can actually get a MRI. So scaphoid fractures, most of them are at the waist here. Oftentimes you see some in the distal third or in the proximal third. And they matter because the blood supply actually comes in distally and then trickles back proximally. So distal third or fractures here, waist, which is the most common, 65% of the time is here, and proximal pole is here. And as you can imagine, if the blood supply comes in here, these tend to heal like gangbusters, and they heal in about 4 to 6 weeks. These heal, and they heal somewhere between 8 to 12 weeks, and the proximal pole fractures don't heal without surgery. So that's why we always want to look at this and talk about what type of surgery and what the chances are of surgery, of needing surgery. So just here's an x-ray. This is why you can see it's hard to see. Here's just a normal wrist film of somebody that fell, right? Just a normal wrist film. But they kept complaining of wrist pain, and so it was seen in clinic, and you get this special view, which is called a scaphoid view, and literally it's taking the wrist and turning it what we call ulnarly deviating it, and it uncovers the bone. And probably anyone in the front row, maybe the front few rows, can actually see the fracture line right there. And if you look here, you can actually still see it. It's just you just can't see it as well. So that's why we get it. If you get an MRI, you can see it even better, right? You can actually see it right there. So that's pretty obvious. And you can get that acutely. You don't have to wait those 2 weeks to get it. So this is a nice way for somebody who needs to get back to work, for somebody who wants a diagnosis, you can actually get this, you know, immediately after the injury to diagnose it. Why and when do we fix it? So we fix it when it's displaced, and displaced means that it has greater than 1 millimeter, so it's moved 1 millimeter, which really isn't that much in the hand, right? But the reason we do is that if it's more displaced, so if it's greater than a millimeter displaced, the chance of the bone not healing goes way up. Less than 1 millimeter, these heal, and they heal somewhere between 90 and 98% of the time. But if they're displaced and we don't fix it, sometimes they go on to what we call a non-union. The bone doesn't heal. And sometimes they go on to really bad wrist arthritis. And this is what we try and prevent. This is a scaphoid fracture that wasn't treated, that didn't heal, and that developed wrist arthritis. And I think you can see how narrow it is at this area here. And this is a patient that came to our clinic presenting with a lot of wrist pain. So when we see fractures like this that are clearly displaced, this one's much more obvious than the last one. You can see the displacement here. These are the ones that we take to surgery. And when we take them to surgery, this is almost what you do 95% of the time, is you put in a screw, and it's a headless compression screw. And if you can see it, it's a little bit wider here and narrower here. And now this is actually a screw coming up from this way, but there's two ways that you can come in it. You can come by the dorsal, the back side of the hand, or actually the front side of the hand and put a screw down here. And this actually compresses the fracture, and it has a variable pitch, meaning that the screw, the distance between the screw threads are bigger here, and it compresses a fracture and it increases the likelihood of it healing. So just to kind of wrap up, sometimes you see these fractures altogether, and usually these are associated with a higher energy mechanism. So you can see that distal ulna fracture here. You see a distal radius fracture here, and then a scaphoid fracture. And these are what you see with like a fall from a scaffold, which we tend to see a lot at our hospital, or motorcycle accidents, car accidents. But these are the ones, and then if you look at the lateral, it looks just like a garble of bones. These are the ones that we have to take to surgery, and they are. I mean, it's big surgery because you have to fix the fracture. So this was actually fixed with the dorsal plates that I was mentioning before. And the reason why is I fixed the fracture here by coming in on the back side of the wrist. And then we actually pinned the wrist because this is a wrist fracture with a dislocation. The last two things we'll go through really quickly are triquetral avulsion fractures, because you may have had this or you may have someone that tells you this. This is a glorified wrist sprain. So what happens is you fall on an outstretched hand, and there's two mechanisms. Sometimes you hyperextend it so much the triquetrum actually hits the back of the distal radius and knocks off a tiny chip of that bone. Sometimes it's actually when you fall, this is where some of the ligaments on the back of the wrist insert, and they just pull off, and they pull off this little fleck of bone here. So when we see these fractures, we tell people it's a wrist sprain. This fracture will never really look like it heals. If you take an x-ray of the same person 20 years down the road, it almost still looks like this, just a little bit more like a pebble, nice and well-rounded. But it doesn't heal back to the bone. They don't have to. They just actually, all you're doing is symptomatic management with a wrist splint and range of motion. And the final one I want to talk about is boxer's fracture. As I mentioned, it's a misnomer. And the reason being is professional boxers have better technique, when this is usually like a brawl fracture, right, in a pub. Usually it's sometimes they come in with evidence of like somebody's tooth around the area. They've hit somebody in the face, and they always say, no, I fell in the bathtub. I think that happens a lot. But this is where they break. And they break here because they drop their knuckle when they punch, right? They kind of drop the hand instead of punching straight on. And the force goes through here, and it breaks at the bone here. And this is the metacarpal neck. Again, this is the area that we talked about, the metaphysis, where the bone is the weakest. And that's what happened. The good news is that, so this is a fifth metacarpal. You sometimes see it in the fourth, but this is the most mobile ray of the hand. So it moves the most. It's most likely to break. It accepts a really high degree of angulation. So that's great for us, right? It can be angulated somewhere between 40 and 70 degrees, meaning that normal is zero. So it can displace a lot before you have to get us to consider surgery because it heals fine. It's typically non-operative. It becomes operative when you see this. When the patient makes a fist and the fingers scissor or they clinically rotate. So the nice part is almost everybody has two hands. So I always say, make a fist. I say, it's going to hurt you. You're not going to hurt it, but I need to see whether we need to operate on you. And they come down once, and if they all point in the same direction, then you don't need to have surgery. And people that don't want to bend their, make a fist like this, you can actually look at your nail beds. And if you look at your nail beds on both sides, they all relatively point up in the same direction. If it's twisted, right, if you have a rotational deformity with a fracture, those nail beds don't point up the right way. So we reduce them, and these get reduced often in the emergency room, and it's this something called a Joss maneuver. But since this piece of bone is so small, you can't really access it. It's right here. So we actually put the force through the finger, and we push up like this to reduce the fracture, and then we put that mold on it. You can immobilize these in 100 different ways. There's about a study out there anyway that you want to do it. So you can use an ACE wrap, right? And the ones that are minimally displaced, you can often say, we actually don't need to get it treated. You can do a symptomatic treatment with an ACE wrap. You can have these nice custom splints made. This is actually called a boxer's cast. If you operate on them, most of the time we end up putting pins in to reduce it. And these are done for that very rotated fracture, right? So if the finger looks rotated, we'll take you to surgery to pin these. You can also put plates on them if you need to. So this ends my talk, but thank you very much. And I think we're going to open up for questions.
I'm actually going to kick it off with a question for Dr. Schroeder, because I think this is very applicable and it's very easy to do. So if someone has a distal radius fracture, in our literature, we sometimes talk about giving vitamin C or taking vitamin C. Can you just comment on that?
So there's a lot of studies out there on the use of vitamin C, there was a great study done that actually showed that the reason people take vitamin C and the reason that we recommend that people take vitamin C after a wrist fracture is there's something called complex regional pain syndrome, which is almost the way to easily describe it is pain out of proportion to the injury. So sometimes people get overstimulated, an overstimulated pain response, and so it hurts so much that they won't move their fingers, that they get really stiff, that they really hurt a lot. And vitamin C, taking 500 milligrams a day for 2 months after an injury, a wrist fracture specifically, decreased the incidence of the CRPS from, I think, somewhere from like 11% to 2%.
And, you know, if you actually have, we bring this up because if you have a friend or you do break your wrist, if you go to the ER, odds are very slim that they'll tell you about vitamin C, by something easy to take, and you could actually make a big difference, okay? I have one more question for Dr. Kanemir, and then we'll open it up for you guys. And this is just kind of technical, and I get this question a lot. You show all these pictures with great hardware, you know, replacements, so forth, plates. The question I want to know is, am I going to set off the airport alarm?
Yeah, this is a routine question we get every single time when we put hardware, and it's 99% of the surgical patients. So depending on where they adjust it, yes, you're going to set the alarms, but you don't need any paper or anything like that. Actually, these new machines, they can see most of this hardware already, the ones that you got to do this in the machine. They can see it wherever in the body too. So you don't need, they don't even ask you anything, but you just tell them that you're going to have, if they beep, then you have surgery, and they will use their wand to confirm that there's some hardware inside of the body. So it will set the alarm. Sometimes it doesn't. I don't know. Sometimes I go with my beeper and it doesn't set off. I don't know. It's, they're adjusting the levels or something.
So the moral of that is if you have surgery with him, you'll be able to do this, right? You guys have any questions out there? Yes, ma'am?
Yeah, following your last response, does having plates and screws preclude you from having future MRIs?
So the question is, that's a great question. So does having plates and screws preclude you from having a future MRI?
Yes.
So you can have MRIs. So it's not like something in your brain or a pacemaker for your heart, okay? It's not like they put some clips for aneurysms in the brain. You cannot have an MRI. If you have a pacemaker, you cannot have an MRI. With the metals we use in orthopedic surgery, you can have MRIs. There's a pitfall, though. The pictures of the MRI next to this hardware is not going to be good enough to interpret them, okay? So if you have a hardware in the shoulder that I put it in, if you get an MRI, yes, you can have the MRI, but the pictures, hard to see what you need to see, because MRIs are done for soft tissues, usually tendons, ligaments, meniscus, etc. The pictures are not going to look as good. Usually, they're not going to look good. If you have titanium versions of it, the pictures are a little better, but still, it's hard to evaluate and get the information that you need to get from an MRI.
Okay. Yes? Red sweater?
Yes. The pictures you showed of the pins in the bone always looked long to me, that they were sticking out. Is that something that you adjust before you finish surgery?
So, can we repeat the question?
Yeah, so the question was in the X-ray that I showed that had pins coming out, they looked long. And the reason they look long is actually they are either put in percutaneously, meaning through the skin, and then we pull them out at about 4 to 6 weeks, depending on the bone and the fracture that we're dealing with. But those always come out. So there are certain times where you actually bend them, break them, bury them. But most of the times, these are put in just by poking through the skin, and then we pull them out later.
Yes, sir?
You mentioned that women tend to fracture more than men. And I wondered if women who are athletes and who are very muscular, does their amount of fracture come down because of the muscularity?
Yeah, so...
Can you repeat the question?
Sure, the question was, in women tend to fracture more than men, but do you have a preventative bias, or are you prevented from fracturing if you're more muscular? And so usually, the answer is that osteoporosis is increased in thin women. And the reason is that if you're more muscular, the chance of you being done weightlifting or something like that, or done running or walking or something like that to actually increase the bone density. So I don't know if there's an actual study out there talking about muscle density, but usually muscle density is correlated with bone strength. So that would be a preventative thing to have more muscle strength.
Yes.
So if you have a fracture,
someone was too sick to operate, for example, they were in a bad accident or something,
could you use what you showed on the wrist, like an outer fixation?
Yeah, that's what we usually do. The question is that if somebody has an elbow injury, a fracture, and they are too sick, they are head injury or there are other issues, they are in intensive care unit, that you cannot take them to the operating room, can you use some other non-surgical methods to treat them, like a cast or a brace? The answer is yes. Obviously, if you cannot take the patient to the operating room, we still try to keep the alignment of the bones, and if they're going to heal, we try to keep them as well aligned as possible until they may need surgery, maybe at the future, or maybe it will heal fine. In that position, and we will reevaluate them. We always try to treat with somehow to control the alignment that it doesn't get worse and it heals in a better position as much as possible, as much as we can control. We use braces, splints, casts as much as we can.
And oftentimes, it's a much shorter procedure to put on that external fixation device. So if they say, well, we won't give you the 5 hours to go in and fix a elbow beautifully like Dr. Kandemir does, but we will give you we think the patient can tolerate 45 minutes of a surgery, then we can put on an X-fix to stabilize the bone. And oftentimes, the just stabilizing the bone with an external fixator actually helps a patient get better because you can transport them easily. If you put one on like a leg, it actually can decrease the blood loss from the fracture and it stabilizes the leg temporarily.
Yes, sir.
Doctor, UCSF Orthopedics accomplishes great things all over the city. Can you describe the work you do in the ER at the gym, your department?
Sure. So the question is what we do in the emergency room at San Francisco General or the Zuckerberg now. We are the consults service for all fractures, also soft tissue injuries, hand and upper extremity. So we take care of, Dr. Lee and I take call for like hand replants. If somebody cuts off a finger or cuts off a wrist, we'll actually come and see that. If somebody tears an ACL and has an associated injury, they consult orthopedics. And so we have our residents there who initially see the fracture after getting consulted by the ER staff. And we will go down and evaluate the patient.
Spine.
Oh, spine as well. So spine
all,
is...
all musculoskeletal injuries, basically.
But, I mean, you were showing images, and it was very impressive what you showed up there. So, and I was surprised you could accomplish all of that in the ER, where things are kind of active.
Yeah, that's yes, it's very hectic. So all of that, so oftentimes we do the provisional management of the fracture. So if it's a fracture that's not sticking out of the skin and has to go to the OR for the operating room emergently for fixation, then we will put a splint on it, reduce it, meaning getting it back in the right position. And if they don't have anything that means that they need to stay in the hospital, meaning that their pain is well controlled, they don't have any acute numbness or tingling, we can send them, then they come to clinic. If they need surgery, then we schedule them from there.
Now, how do you treat a displaced shoulder?
Can you repeat the question?
The question is, how do you treat a displaced shoulder? I guess you mean a dislocated shoulder or the ball is out of the socket. So the acutely, what you end up in an emergency room, especially the first time, unless you are a kind of repeated dislocation, sometimes people can put back to get their shoulder back in there. If you dislocated your shoulder, you end up in the emergency room. The ER physicians are going to give you some sedation, some medications that you can relax your muscles. And by just pulling on the arm in certain positions, you can just put it back in where it's supposed to be. And we usually put in a brace for a couple of weeks and we start physical therapy. This is the treatment for the first-time dislocations. If you have multiple dislocations, then it's a big different issue. We usually end up in a clinic because you have multiple of them. The ER management is the same. You may need surgery. The tendency is age-related, actually. The younger you are when you dislocated your shoulder the first time, there is a higher chance that you're going to re-dislocate it again. It's like if you are less than 17 or so, there's 90% chance. Although if you are like 60-year-old or something, then the redislocation rate is smaller, but there are some other associated rotator cuff tears. Mm-hmm.
Another question.
Do you ever recommend that people take glucosamine or chondroitin all post-surgery to, I guess that helps your cartilage, I'm not sure. Yeah.
So these are common, like, so the question, sorry, I keep forgetting. The question is, do we recommend glucosamine or chondroitin sulfate or combinations of this that are available over the counter after the surgeries, especially the ones that involves the joint cartilage? These are the supplements. These are not medications. To tell the truth, there's not much scientific evidence that if they are helpful or not. On the other hand, as I said, these are not medications. There are really no side effects at all. And although I don't believe much because I try to rely on the scientific evidence, I have seen patients who benefited significantly although I'm biased that I don't think it works. So I don't see any downside why not to use it. But the primary reason to use a glucosamine or chondroitin sulfate is usually arthritis, not in the setting of the fracture. But I'm not against it. As I said, I have seen patients who had great benefit, especially regarding the pain control and wise.
Probably one more question before. Go ahead.
How do you treat calcium deposits in, for example, a shoulder joint, and is there any way from preventing that from reoccurring?
So the question is, if you have calcium deposits in the shoulder joint, how you treat it and how you prevent the recurrence? So the thing you are talking about is probably the calcium deposits in the tendons itself. It's basically calcific tendinitis, it's called. The calcium deposits in the tendon itself, and it gets inflamed. It causes a lot of significant pain, actually. The way to treat it, you start with physical therapy first and anti-inflammatory medications. The second line of treatment, you can try some poking with needles. Actually, it has been described if the patient can tolerate it, or do an arthroscopic surgery to try to treat this calcium, to take out this calcium deposits. The recurrence is something real. What to do to avoid the recurrence or to prevent the recurrence? There's not much shown to be very beneficial, but we try anti-inflammatory medications routinely, not for pain control, but to prevent the recurrence.
I think this sort of ends our formal session, but we could stick around and answer more questions if you guys are interested, okay? Thank you very much.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.